Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence by Jane's. I'm your host, Harry Kemsley, and as usual, my co-host, Sean Corbett. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Harry. Good to be back.
Sean, we previously talked about this topic, North Korea, and we acknowledged at the time that it was a very hard nut to crack from an open source perspective because it's a relatively closed environment, comparatively closed to other parts of the world, certainly. But it is very topical. It's come very much back into the news for a variety of reasons. And I thought that therefore today we should revisit North Korea, to which I am delighted to introduce to the audience two experts on it, Rachel Min-Young Lee. Hello, Rachel.
Hi.
Thank you for joining. And to welcome back Christina Variali, a member of Jane's. Thank you for coming back to us.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So let's start with a quick update on what is going on in North Korea at the moment, Rachel, that you are seeing in the work you are doing. And then we'll start to unravel that, going through Christina to do the same, and then start picking out some of the lessons from an open source perspective. So, Rachel, what are you seeing right now in North Korea?
Thank you, Harry, for that introduction. And I'm very delighted to be on this show. What is going on in North Korea? I think there's so many things going on, as we all know. Starting with last week, 2 weeks ago, with North Korea's allegation that South Korean drones had violated the airspace of the capital, Pyongyang. And then there was the demolition by the North Koreans of sections of inner Korean roads and railways. So it looked for a while that tensions might flare up again on the Korean Peninsula. But at this point in time, I think we can safely say that Kim Jong-un doesn't want to escalate tensions, which then brings us to the question of why. And in the meantime, as all of this was happening, we've gotten reports about North Korea sending troops to Russia, to the battlefields. It sounds like about 3,000 soldiers have already been sent, and that 10,000 more will be sent by December. This has been confirmed by the South Korean intelligence and confirmed again by the U.S. The Secretary of Defense.
All right. Each of those topics, I suspect, Rachel, we could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about, but we'll zero in on those in a second. Christina, what are you seeing? Anything different or largely the same?
So very similar to what Rachel set out already, but I think zooming out slightly, one of the threads that for me I think is common across both of those events and a couple of other things we've seen this year in North Korea is the beginning of this year, they announced a change of stance vis-a-vis unification with South Korea and have essentially said that they are going to remove that from their ideology. We were expecting that to have then been removed from the constitution as a goal of the country earlier this month. And we've not really had too much clarity on whether that's happened or not. And the reason I say that this is kind of a thread through all of these events is I think there's a link between North Korea's change in position on unification with South Korea and the elevation of the threat that we've seen and kind of North Korea's narratives around that, including the drone incident. North Korea's position with external actors, Russia included, but some others as well, and how North Korea is then using and leveraging those external relations to mitigate and manage maybe some internal risks that it's seeing, particularly around the control of information and the access to outside information that North Koreans maybe are having an increased access to, especially since the reopening of the borders post-COVID.
So are we seeing signs from within North Korea in any shape or form that suggest that North Koreans are getting some insight into the world outside the borders of North Korea?
I think that is an incredibly difficult question to answer and kind of one that's really key to understanding North Korean national security perspectives and country stability. For me, I think we are seeing some narratives come out of state media and particularly from Kim himself that give me an indication that the risk of this might have increased slightly. So, for example, after the drone attack, the North Koreans published images of the leaflets that were supposedly scattered by that drone, which I think is a relatively unusual thing to do. And that's followed Kim making statements about South Korean media narratives that have, quote unquote, tarnished the image of the country following floods that occurred in August and July this year, claiming that the narratives that South Korean media were putting out about the number of deaths and the impact on the country were false.
Right.
To me, that suggests that there's an effort by the leadership to almost try and get on top of some of those narratives that are maybe entering the country and increasing that access to outside information.
Reshaping them in a way that allows the population to rationalise them away.
Exactly. Right. Taking control of them almost.
Right.
And in the context of the change of approach to unification, I think that's quite an interesting thing to be doing, given that we have also seen that change of stance be used to elevate the threat from South Korea, not just in a military sense, but also in the information sense.
So, Rachel, I'll come back to you in just a moment on this point of reunification, whether it's still an ambition or not. I'll come back to that point in a second. Before I do that, Rachel, Sean, just a quick thought. What do you imagine, from your background, the organizations you've worked for will be thinking about some of these things we just heard about? What are their perspectives of these activities and statements, or non-statements in some cases?
So I think they'll have the same challenges as we do within the open source domain in terms of validating what we're seeing. You know, how much of it is rhetoric? How much of it is, you know, trying to message the outside, but also the inside world, and saying, okay, which of this is true? So it's interesting what Rachel said, that to validate the special forces, in inverted commas, troops that are being deployed to Russia. But actually, we will see, and we are seeing evidence of that, you know, as they go to Russia, when they're outside North Korea, it does give us more opportunities to see what's actually going on.
Mm.
And of course, you know, when they actually show on video roads blowing up, it's quite easy on the imagery to say, yeah, that is that road and it has been blown up. So validating what's going on, and then, you know, using experts, and not necessarily just from within the intelligence community, because I know, you know, Rachel had worked with those organizations before, but from an open source perspective, saying, okay, what does this mean? What are we seeing here? What's the so what about it?
Mm.
And how do we know? So, you know, North Korea is the most difficult intelligence problem set, if you like. And therefore, we've got to use every single source we can to
right,
try and
right.
understand
all,
it.
All source approach. So Rachel, just before we perhaps move into the how are we getting these insights and making these assertions? What's your perspective on this reunification aspect that Christina's mentioned? What are you seeing and hearing? What's your view on it?
So from my point of view, in tracking North Korean media statements, the commentaries, it's been clear for some years, probably going back to the spring of 2019, in the wake of the failed Hanoi summit, that North Korea was shifting away from unification, South Korea. Definitely this shift from away from this notion of unification, it did not happen overnight. It's been happening for a while. So this, you know, a lot of people ask, you know, is this something that Kim Jong-un at some point in the future might go back on? Would he ever talk about unification again? And my assessment is probably not, because he has taken such extreme measures to make the point that the two Koreas are now two separate countries, that
Right. They're
not part of the same nation. If Kim's intention had been to maybe leave some flexibility down the road to maybe go back on his policy, I think he would have handled all of this very differently. For example, he didn't have to tell the domestic audience about this policy change. He didn't have to tell them about the demolition of the sections of the inner Korean roads and railways, right? This is going back to last week. He didn't have to do that. But, you know, telling the domestic public about these developments, about the policy change, I mean, he announced the policy change in an important party meeting in December, and then followed up again in another important speech at the Supreme People's Assembly, which is the North Korean parliament. So, you know, it doesn't get any more authoritative than that. When Kim Jong-un makes a speech, I mean, that is the most important thing. So there's no going back. And to tell the people, you know, you're essentially saying there's no going back, right? Yeah. Because once you tell your domestic audience that this is how things are going to be, then, you know, you're essentially not leaving yourself any leeway for policy change.
Right. Is there, this is perhaps a speculative question, so apologies in advance, but given how limited our perspective into what the North Korean population are thinking and doing, is there any likelihood that there was shock in the population of North Korea that their leader will have decided to consider the two countries separate? Because for generations since the Korean War, the objective has been very much about a single Korea. So will there have been shock, perhaps even disappointment, do you think?
That's an excellent and a very relevant question, and I would say yes. And the reason for that is that North Korean media, there was not a single day when the North Korean media would not talk about unification. Mm-hmm. And this shifted in October 2019, I would say in the wake of the working level nuclear talks between the US and North Korea in October 2019. They stopped running commentaries, actually. And then when those commentaries went away from the Party Daily, the commentaries also about unification, South Korea, all of those went away too. I'm not North Korean, was never lived there. So, I don't have that personal experience of, you know, having led that life on the ground. But I would think that just judging from North Korean media and what people are exposed to, that unification is something that's ingrained, right, all your life. And for that to just be taken away one day, for the leader to just make a statement or speech saying that we're now two separate countries. And recently, just last week, he said, well, now that we're no longer part of the same nation, we are justified in launching a nuclear attack on South Korea if South Korea infringes on our sovereignty, you know, which tells you one of the reasons why he wanted to, roll back on the unification policy and his South Korea policy overall. But going back to your question, the long-winded way of saying yes, I think it would have been shocking. And I think that is why we are seeing North Korea executing this policy the way it has been. So decision-making is one thing. I've said that it took them a few years to come to this policy. So it's not an overnight development, decision-making wise. But that is separate from rolling out the policy. And it's been interesting how, you know, Christina earlier mentioned, the Supreme People's Assembly, the constitutional revision. We had expected to see an announcement on the revisions of the constitution relating to South Korea unification and even a definition of North Korea's territory. North Korean media's readout of that parliamentary session mentioned a constitutional revision, but not relating to any of these topics. So that indicated to me one or both of these things. There are domestic sensitivities.
Yep.
Or North Korea wants to keep all of this a surprise, just for strategic ambiguity, because he wants to put himself, give himself the advantage, as he maybe launch some kind of a surprise, start a conflict maybe in the Yellow Sea, make it harder for South Korea to plan ahead.
Right.
So for me, it was one of those two things when they did not announce the constitutional revisions.
Okay, so Sean, I want to come back to you in just a second. Christina, I'd be really interested to see your thoughts on what Rachel's just said there. But before I go to Christina, Sean, I'll come back to you in a moment. But the lack of apparent wish to now reunificate, does that change the military perspective of North Korea in any other way? Do we see that there may well be less threat militarily as a result of this?
So I'm really quite worried about this, actually, because at the end of the day, And I'm not a North Korean expert, but if you've got a population where below the sort of surface is this hope that one day the hope that the reunification is there, and suddenly that gets taken away with you. If your population loses hope, then you're in a spot of bother, actually. Mm. And if you then, so trying to think of this strategically, sort of, you know, why is it they're cozying up to Russia, for example? Are the two linked? You know, do they want to become a bigger actor on the stage? If North Korean soldiers start coming back in body bags, how will that change the perspective within North Korea as well? Mm. And I'm sure we're going to get on to talk to it in fact, but, you know, what I'm intrigued by as well is that China has always been the, you know, the big partner, no question, with North Korea, you know, for all the reasons that we know economically and geographically. With them cozying up to Russia, does that change that dynamic at all, or is it still just a small thing? But it does just ask the question, and I'm not answering them, obviously, is that why are they having so much to do with Russia? I mean, we've heard about the arms, so the shells that are being actually exported over there. So they're actively deciding to take a bigger role on the international stage.
Any clues on that, Christina?
Yeah, so I want to very quickly pick up on one of the points that Rachel made and add something to it. So I completely agree with everything she said, but mentioning kind of the hypothesis for why we might not have seen those constitutional changes or at least a public announcement of them. Completely agree, domestic sensitivities, and the second hypothesis, which has now completely escaped my mind.
We'll come back to it. Let me ask you a slightly different question then.
Yeah.
The link between what appears to be a strategic change in their policy and the link into Russia, mm-hmm. is that likely to be related?
I think it probably is. I think given the timings of these things as well, and looking at North Korea's evolution of foreign policy, as Rachel said, kind of from 2019 onwards, but in particular from 2023 onwards and post-COVID, tracking North Korea's foreign relations more broadly, mm-hmm. There's definitely been a significant uptick and interest in wanting to engage with particular partners. Russia is obviously a quite prominent one for the obvious reasons of it being a large and significant country. It gives North Korea credibility and kudos, mm-hmm. and kind of they can portray that back in domestically to create legitimacy and credibility for the regime. But you look at some of the other countries that they're engaging with, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. Vietnam's a really interesting one. There's also been military delegations between those two countries meeting recently, in which North Korean state media didn't report on the most recent meeting, but Vietnamese media did. And they discussed things like engaging in military training cooperation, military healthcare, strategic thinking, strategic education, equipment cooperation. Mm-hmm. So although we don't have the same level of formalization of that relationship than we've seen with Russia, North Korea are definitely kind of putting out the feelers as to who is willing to engage. And I think that's possibly one restraining factor on how they've acted vis-a-vis the change of position with South Korea. If you want to leverage international and external engagement with countries that still care about the international system to some extent, you probably don't want to be putting yourself in a position where you're maybe portraying that you're on the brink of a war with, you know, a country that borders you. For example, would that, and this is a hypothesis that I think is worth thinking about, would that type of stance disengage Vietnamese cooperation?
Right.
It may or may not, but I think thinking about these engagements as a package, not singling out North Korea-Russia relations, not singling out North Korea, you know, inter-Korean relations, and kind of looking holistically at how North Korea is looking at kind of external partners, I think is incredibly helpful with trying to understand and unpack all of this.
So, Richard, that almost sounds like North Korea is trying to position itself as more of a world-level player. It's trying to get more involved in regional dynamics. It's trying to see itself as influential in a major conflict with one of its neighbours, with Russia, into Ukraine. So, in a minute, we're going to come on to this. So how do we understand what Korea does? Because we can't actually read it in their press as such. We can't actually listen to them talking about it because that's such a closed environment. But what's your expert view of this hypothesis I'm suggesting that North Korea is just trying to position itself as being a much bigger player on the world stage.
I completely agree with that assessment. And the reason for that is that since October 2023, North Korean official statements, particularly those from the foreign ministry, have said consistently, we are going to work closely with the Russians to create a security structure.
Right.
Putin said something very similar on the eve of his arrival in Pyongyang in June, where, you know, in an article that he contributed to the North Korean Party Daily, which is the most authoritative media outlet, he said that he would work with Kim Jong-un to create a security structure in Eurasia. So, you know, they have been coordinating. And, you know, what we're seeing now with Kim Jong-un sending his troops to Russia, I think, you know, all of this ties in together. You know, it's one thing to send weapons to Russia, but it's a completely different level of commitment to send such a huge number of your own men to another country, you know, to another country's battlefield. You know, and by doing this, you know, Kim Jong-un creates this image of being a major player.
Yeah.
It's a major player working shoulder to shoulder with the Russians to create an alternate global order, right? Anti-US, anti-West global order. And I think this is one of the main reasons, one of the reasons why Kim Jong-un made that decision to send troops to
just
Russia.
To take that thought one small step further. Are there any other nations that we think they might want to engage with? We talked about Cambodia, Vietnam. Are there other countries in that region that they may wish to connect with?
We have seen two fairly high-level delegations visiting from Belarus to North Korea. So Belarus definitely is one country that I think we should keep an eye on. And you can see, you know, like Belarus is a close friend of Russia, right? Sure. So you can also see Kim Jong-un, North Korea, using Russia to improve ties, expand ties with countries that where Russia has some leverage.
Right. All right. Sorry, Christina, go ahead.
Can I just add another country to that? Outside of the region, I think Nicaragua is a really interesting one.
I'd just like to ask, have we not seen some reports of them being in South America as well?
Yeah. So I think it was late 2023, although I might have got that date wrong. North Korea and Nicaragua agreed to the mutual reopening of embassies. Nicaragua is absolutely not my bag, but from what I understand, those in power in Nicaragua are part of the same family and have the same relationships as those that North Korea used to connect with under Kim's grandfather and father.
Right.
Weapon sales is something that is probably quite high up the agenda, given the history and the kind of connections between the two countries. And that Nicaragua is also in a position of wanting to position itself away from sanctions that the US has imposed on it. So kind of, again, looking to be part of an alternative world order. So not isolating itself, but looking for this creation of something that enables interaction externally where necessary.
Got it. All right. I'm going to ask yourself, Rachel, and Christina two questions, and we're going to take them in turn. And Sean and I will try and moderate as we go through. So I want you to take yourself forward a couple of years. What do you think we're looking at then in terms of the Korean Peninsula? And then the second question, I want you to go back a couple of years, and I want you to pretend that you are a brand new analyst who's just been told, hi, you've got a new desk. You're running the North Korea desk, and you've not touched North Korea before. Both of you are extremely expert and knowledgeable about North Korea, but I'm going to ask you to go back to a time when you weren't. And look through the time between then and now in the second question and help me understand, what do you use? If you're going to advise the younger you, looking at North Korea from an intelligence perspective for the first time, on what to use from open sources and how to use it, what would you advise? So two questions are, go forward 2 years, what do you expect to see? Go back a few years, how do you advise the younger Rachel, the younger Christina on how to attack this problem of the closed society of North Korea? And on this occasion, I'm going to ask Christina to go first, because Rachel, I asked you the question first. So What are you going to say about 2 years from now, Christina?
They are both excellent questions. And I think part of the challenge that we have with North Korea is that sometimes things don't play out as we anticipate.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that a lot recently. You know, the examples Rachel cited earlier, we would probably have looked at the narratives that, that the North Korean regime put out following the drone attacks. And made assessments that this is going to escalate, like Rachel said, and it hasn't.
And almost did the opposite, almost.
So I think, you know, there are certain indicators that we would be looking at along the way as to what that's going to look like. I'm talking around this because I'm trying to think about, you know, what does this look like? What are the things that I'm going to be tracking to kind of pave the way to that three year look ahead? I think one will be the relationship with Russia. I think that's going to be really, really key. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible that that relationship expands significantly over that time period. I think it's, I don't see a scenario right now in which we have full-scale mobilization of the KPA fighting on the front with Russia.
Right.
I think there are multiple steps in which we would need to see before we got there. But certainly I think it's possible that North Korea's military capabilities could advance based on the experience they're getting from collaborations with Russia, not just in terms of military technology, but also the experience that they're potentially going to get from being on the battlefield.
Yeah.
I am getting to kind of where this goes in 3 to 5 years' time. That could result in a more emboldened North Korea in terms of how they're interacting with
greater confidence.
You know, part of the criticism that we see or that we can sometimes see, especially in South Korean media, regarding the perceived threat from North Korea is they rely heavily on their nuclear weapons for deterrence. Their conventional assets are maybe not quite comparable anymore. They, yes, they have vast numbers of infantry, but the degradation of their conventional capabilities overall degrades the threats that they compose. That to me would be the most worrying scenario, that the degradation of that conventional capability has evolved over that period.
So
that's the kind of thing that I would be tracking.
Maybe that's what we'll leave you with for now, and we'll come back again to see if there's anything else you could use to help you track that. Rachel, what are your thoughts looking forward a couple of 3 years?
Christina already raised some excellent points. I would just add that for me, the priority would be the security dynamic on and around the Korean Peninsula. So, you know, where would North Korea's relations with the U.S. be in, you know, 3 years' time from now? Is there a possibility that the next U.S. administration might accept some form of arms control talks, or talks focused more on risk reduction rather than denuclearization, which would then, of course, raise a lot of issues in Seoul and probably in Tokyo as well. And, you know, this program is not really about South Korea, but, you know, will then that lead to more nuclear debate in Seoul? You know, how would that nuclear debate then evolve in South Korea? You know, because that's another topic of debate. DPRK-China relations. Things are not looking great between the two countries. I mean, you know, this year was the 75th anniversary of forging of diplomatic ties. There's nothing going on between the two countries. North Korea is celebrating that with the Russians. you know, this what we're seeing now between North Korea and China, North Korea's position on China. My question is this a tactical change? Is Kim Jong-un just miffed at Xi Jinping because Xi Jinping didn't deliver on something that Kim wanted? Or is this a bigger strategic shift in policy?
Yeah.
You know, and this goes back to the bigger question of what is North Korea looking for from Russia? You know, what is Kim Jong-un, what has he gotten from Russia? What is he looking forward to getting from Russia? that might possibly offset what the Chinese have been providing the North Koreans, right? And, you know, the question of DPRK-Russia relations. You know, I've been saying for quite some time now that we should probably be more imaginative when it comes to DPRK-Russia relations. I still think that there are most experts, at least North Korea experts, tend to think that this relationship is transactional and commercial in nature. I think that we should maybe step out of our, you know, mold maybe, and think bigger, and think the unimaginative, you know. We would not have imagined 2 years ago that North Korea would have sent, you know, tens of thousands of containers of weapons to Russia. We would not have imagined that North Korea would be sending soldiers to Russia. You know, a lot of people 2 years ago were saying, well, North Korea still doesn't have anything to offer to the Russians. You know, why would Putin want closer relations with Russia, with the DPRK? And we turned, many of us turned out to be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to look at this within the broader context of, you know, as Christina mentioned earlier, the reorientation of North Korea's foreign policy. You know, the moment Kim Jong-un decided to walk away from the decades-old policy of normalizing relations with Washington through denuclearization, you know, that was a huge step, you know, and you know, he, when he walked away from that, I mean, I think he had a plan in mind. Yeah. Maybe it wasn't like a firm plan, but, you know, at around the time that he decided to walk away from this Washington-centric, U.S.-centric policy, you know, we started to see him pivot also to China and Russia. So we're talking about a fundamental policy change. So it's this goes beyond Ukraine, and, you know, this goes beyond the war in Ukraine.
It does sound, again, to my perception anyway, Rachel, like a country that's trying to position itself on the world stage. The hegemony that it felt it started to show to the U.S., was getting under the skin, and they wanted to position itself as not part of the West's perspective, doing what the West wanted. It wanted to assert itself. That's the way it feels to a non-expert outsider like myself looking in. Let me nonetheless spin the question back to that second question. So, Christina, when we last spoke about North Korea, one of the things we talked about was the fact that you can't read it directly because there isn't that much to read. You read by inference and indirect. So again, go back to the young Christina straight out of university, hasn't even done her master's yet, and you're helping her understand how to go about this North Korean study you've asked her to do. What are you going to give her in terms of guidance?
I think step one, read key state media outlets and track the type of content. So who's saying it? Who's publishing these things? Are they statements from Kim? Are they statements from senior leadership? Are they general commentaries? Track the who.
Right.
Track the what. What's the content? Are we looking at big, bold statements that are very strategic in nature? Are we focused on content vis-a-vis South Korea? Are we focused on content vis-a-vis the US? Are we focused on military content? Are we focused on domestic social and economic growth? What is the content? What are we talking about?
Yeah.
And then the third thing to look at is the frequency. How often are these things being talked about? Are they in reaction to a particular external event or external commentary? Are they in reaction to something going on internally within the country? Why are these statements happening, and how frequently are they happening?
Right.
I think that would be a really good starting foundation to try and understand the narratives and the change. I think it's very difficult to come at this particular issue without understanding patterns. I think we had this conversation in quite a lot of depth last time.
Yeah.
So by tracking those three things, you're then going to start to build that picture for yourself of those patterns. What's normal, what's not normal. I think that would probably be where I'd tell.
Very good. Yeah, very, very good. Young Rachel, Ron Christine will be very pleased to have that advice, I'm sure. Now, Rachel, turning to you, patterns, understanding the trends, understanding what's being said, how frequently is what Christina's offered. What would you add to that for the younger Rachel getting started in her studies of North Korea intelligence perspectives?
I fully appreciate Christina's readout of North Korean propaganda analysis methodology, which basically is level audience, right? Timing, tone, everything being context. I would say I would probably key in on the most common mistakes that I see North Korea analysts making, and maybe tell the younger Rachel not to make those mistakes. So one of the most common mistakes that I see is that we have this tendency to tie every key North Korean action to the U.S. So one of the most common narratives that you'll see in any given newspaper article or commentary about North Korea is, yes, North Korea is doing this to get U.S. attention. Yes, North Korea is doing this because we're in the lead up to a U.S. presidential election. Maybe that's part of it, but it's not all of it. And sometimes it has nothing to do with the U.S. So I would say maybe instead of just focusing on the superficial and maybe the lower hanging fruit, maybe try to look more inside North Korea. Right, the domestic developments, because what North Korea does is often shaped by what's going on at home, right? As is the case with all countries' foreign policy. It's never just about one factor. When North Korea decides to conduct a nuclear test, it's probably domestic factors plus external factors. And cherry picking. I think North Korea is very unique in that a lot of things that they say tends to be interesting. There's a lot of colorful language involved, like a lot of harsh rhetoric. And a lot of times what they say sounds very alarming. It sounds like this is the first time they've said this. I guess this also goes back to the importance of collection and baselining, really, to make sure that what you're seeing is maybe not that, to make sure that what you're seeing now is maybe not that unique. Right. And if it is, then maybe you should look at the bigger trend, which that goes back to my next point, which is that you shouldn't really over parse, right? Parsing is important, but oftentimes, one event is maybe one data point. And, maybe that data point is the data point, but oftentimes it's just one of the many data points. So maybe refrain from jumping into conclusions, right, as tempting as that may be, especially in this day and age, of social media and Twitter, and when you want to be one of the first ones to get your voice out there, maybe take some time to do the deeper dive analysis. I think that's it for me.
Sure, I'm going to have to come to you because I think Rachel has very carefully drawn us around to the T word, to tradecraft, and also that she said right at the end there that the first bit of news you read is almost certainly not right, or at least not as right as it's going to be. So your thoughts on the tradecraft around North Korea as an analyst?
I'll come to that. But first I want to answer your other question about, have I been an analyst a few years ago, not understanding North Korea?
Yeah.
The first thing I would be going to Rachel and Christina. And the reason for that is because certainly from a UK perspective, is that our understanding of what's happening in North Korea was really poor. Certainly the nuances that are delivered from the understanding of the strategic level and the policy level. Now, at the tactical level, it's quite easy. There's that much surveillance going on that if there was any indication there's going to be any tactical events, we'd know in advance. So right, looking at that. But in terms of the big strategy, I would be asking ask that question. And Rachel's answer doesn't surprise me because we've talked about it before, is that my concern about North Korea, and this kind of answers the tradecraft point, is that there are so few data points that you know what it's like. If there's a void of information, you'll fill that void. Mm-hmm. And so are we overinterpreting everything we've seen just because? And it's the same on the imagery side, actually. I'm doing some image analysis on it. You see something, is that significant? Because I've seen an image of it. It might just be normal behavior, and we just don't know. So it's exactly as I always say, the first information isn't necessarily the right one, but if it's all you've got, be careful not to overinterpret it. And use all sources that are available.
All right. So I'm going to come to all three of you in a moment for the one takeaway for the audience that you want them to leave from this podcast. And as I leave you to now turn cogs about that, so you come up with your one takeaway. I think what I've heard today, which is particularly interesting, is that we couldn't have foreseen what we are seeing about North Korea, that despite the longevity of the studies of North Korea, the patterns that we formed, the understandings we have formed, despite the difficulties of doing that, I think you both said that nobody could have said, even a number of months ago, that we would be in a place where Korean troops would be on the ground in Russia preparing to be involved in a battle, and all the things we've just talked about, that was unforeseeable. That's interesting. But there's something else you said, Rachel, that I also want to key on, which is that analysts therefore need to continue to be imaginative. And I would add to that word curious about what they're seeing, continuing to dig and understand. And that takes time. And on asking you what you would tell your younger selves, you both described a long-term process. Neither of you said, read this, understand that, and you'd be about right. You both said, this is going to take a long time. You need to build a picture, a long-term, don't overpass things, but equally don't spend too little time doing it. It's a long-term endeavor. That's what I'm taking away. It's a complex intelligence challenge, but one that really experience has to be the forerunner in terms of how you become an expert analyst for North Korea. That's my summary of the last 40 minutes or so. So, Rachel, I'll come to you first. What is the one takeaway you want the audience to have from this? This is where Sean is horrified that everyone's going to take away the one thing he's got in mind. He's got to then think of another one very quickly. So Sean, start thinking your second and third. Rachel, what is your one takeaway for the audience?
Oh boy, that's hard because you've done such an excellent summary of our session. I would say look long term, because and think long term, because North Korea plays the long game. And I think we're seeing that now.
Yeah,
between DPRK and Russia. Yeah.
I like that. I'm reminded by that statement of a phrase I heard from a very senior Arab sheikh who said, "I can't be late, Harry. I measure time in millennia." And when you think about that, that's a very long-term perspective of where we need to be looking, but maybe not quite that far. Christina, what's your one takeaway?
I think building on what you've both said, challenge assumptions. We all have our own assumptions,
right?
And we should be challenging them every single day. If we can't challenge them ourselves, find people to challenge them for us.
Right.
And one of the things that Rachel said about, the tendency to pin what North Korea does on the US.
US, yeah.
And yet, if we just opened our mind that tiny little bit more and said, what if that's not true?
Yeah.
I think there'd be a lot more kind of credible hypothesis development in relation to...
There are certain imaginative hypotheses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Challenge assumptions all the time.
Very good. Sean?
Obviously, I agree with all of that. but in this case, and this map sounds slightly counterintuitive, though, we need to take a whole-of-society approach to North Korea. We're all looking at the senior hierarchy, Kim and all the rest of it, like, okay, what is he thinking? How is he dealing with Putin and all the rest of it? So it's two elements. First, look at it from also the Russian perspective, the Chinese perspective. So it's not just about North Korea. But actually, I am actually deeply worried, just delving into the intelligence again, because, if the body bags start coming back and if this traction with Russia doesn't go as well as planned and, say Putin gets removed, and let's face it, all eyes are still on the US elections. Where does that leave Kim? So if you start to, and of course, as the society starts to slightly open, I know it's only limited, but, with the Russian tourists apparently coming in and all the rest of it, and we're seeing definitely evidence on imagery that is being prepared for. So as that information, therefore, definitely will start leaking out, but also leaking in, there's a population that has now got no hope of unification, of seeing its population come back, its soldiers come back, in body bags, and that you add to the infiltration of information, does that then foment a societal change that cannot be controlled by the leadership?
Yeah, well, we will have to wait and see. Well, at that point then, Rachel, Christina, thank you. Let me thank you very sincerely for your contribution. I'm always struck by the expertise that we bring to this podcast, particularly on things that are so difficult to understand. So I'm very, very grateful, Rachel and Christina, for you bringing that expertise and experience. Can I also pre-invite you to a follow-up on this? This is the second time we've had the pleasure of your company, Christina. It would be great to keep doing this, because one of the things I've noticed about this podcast when we do the revisits is that we have two types of revisit, one that we would kind of expect, and that was about online, but with some surprises, and then this one, which is full of surprises. And I think this particular podcast has reminded us that staying curious means we'll come back to this and find something that we didn't expect. So, Rachel, thank you for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you so much. And this was great. I enjoyed it greatly.
Very good. Thank you, Christina.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. It was a great discussion.
And for the listeners, if anything you've heard today you'd like to delve into more, please send us questions. Many of you do. And some of those questions actually shape future podcasts. If there's anything you'd like us to look at in particular, let us know. We'll try and get to it. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.